pray that you would be with us and keep us and others too. We thank you, Lord, and bless you and commit our ways to you. Amen. We are in Leviticus. This portion is chapters 1 through 5. It's called Vayikra, and he called. This essay is called the Offered Beast. The Offered Beast. It's a quote from Leviticus 1. A man who shall bring near from amongst you an offering to God from the animals, from the cattle, and from the flock, you shall bring near your offering. So, I don't know if you got any sense of this, but according to the Hasidic master, Rabbi Schnur Zalman of Liadi, he notes that the above-quoted verse contains a syntactical anomaly. In other words, the statement doesn't sound like it should. I don't know how many of you are Star Wars fans, but sometimes it's like listening to Yoda talk, right? I mean, Yoda always says things backwards, and it's obvious what he means, but he doesn't communicate like other people communicate. Well, when that happens in Hebrew, when it sounds like it's something that Yoda is saying, right, then there's attention attracted to it, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. A more straightforward way of expressing its intent would have been to say, a man from amongst you who shall bring near an offering. Instead, it reverses the word order to say, a man who shall bring near from amongst you an offering, implying that the offering is brought from amongst you. Indeed, says Rabbi Schnur Zalman, the person bringing the offering is bringing it from within his or her own self. The sacrificed animal is a projection. In the extra-human sphere, this word extra-human means outside or beyond the human sphere. I'm not sure why the Rebbe just doesn't say it like that instead of this language, extra-human sphere. It's of a process transpiring in the intra-human universe, from within the human universe, and we'll talk a little bit about this expression too. The human being, say the sages, is a world in miniature. The world contains oceans and continents, forests and deserts, humans and beasts. So too does the human being. The human psyche includes a subconscious sea and a terrestrial persona. It has lush forests and barren deserts, and it has a human soul and an animal soul, something we'll talk a little bit about too. The human soul, also called the godly soul, embodies all that is upward reaching, the transcendent in us. It gravitates to its source in God, driven by an all-consuming love for God and the desire to lose itself within God's all-pervading essence. Its modes of expression are the thoughts, speech, and deeds of Torah, the means by which we achieve closeness and attachment to our Creator. The animal soul is the self that we share with all living creatures, a self that is driven and fulfilled by its physical needs and desires. Its vehicles of expression are the endeavors of material life. A man who shall bring near from amongst you an offering to God from the animals, from the cattle, and from the flock, you shall bring near your offering. When a person brings an animal from their paddock as a gift to God, the gesture is of limited meaning unless they also offer the animal from within their own self. What is to be done with this animal? The beast within us has not been placed there just so that it should be suppressed or uprooted. Much grain is produced with the might of the ox, it says in Proverbs 14. Remark the wisest of men, Solomon, and the Hasidic masters say that this is a reference to the animal inside our hearts. As an ox run amok, will trample and destroy, but when dominated by a responsible human vision and harnessed to its plow, the beast's vigor translates into much grain, a far more bountiful crop than what human energy alone could produce. The same is true of the beast and man. Nothing, not even the godly soul's keenest yearnings, matches the intensity and vigor with which the animal soul pursues its desires. Left to its own devices, the animal soul tends towards corrupt and destructive behavior. But the proper guidance and training can eliminate the negative expressions of these potent drives and exploit them towards good and godly ends. The first type of korban described in the book of Leviticus is the olah, the ascent offering, commonly referred to as the burnt offering. The olah is unique in that it is an absolute offering. After it is slaughtered in the temple courtyard and its blood is poured upon the altar, it is brought up to the top of the altar and is burned in its entirety as a fiery pleasure unto God. The burning of something in the physical counterpart, the burning of something is the physical counterpart of the sublimation process described above. When a substance is burned, its outer material form is eliminated, releasing the energy locked within. This is the inner significance of the korban, of the sacrifice. An animal energy within our psyche is divested of its material forms and offered upon the altar of service to God. After detailing the various types of ascent offerings, the Torah goes on to discuss the other two primary categories of offerings, the sin offering, the korban chatat, and the peace offering, the korban shelamim. As with the ascent offering, the blood of these offerings was poured upon the altar. But unlike the holy burnt offering, only certain parts of the sin and peace offerings ascended by fire. The Torah designates certain veins of fat, called chalavim, which should be removed and burned. But the meat of the korban was eaten under special conditions of holiness. The meat of the sin offering was eaten by the priests, and that of the peace offering by the person who brought the offering, with certain portions given to the priests. These are portions of our material lives, which, like the ascent offering, are wholly converted into holiness. The money given to charity, the leather made into tefillin, the energy expended in Torah study, prayer, and the performance of a mitzvah. But there is also money we spend to feed our families, the leather we make into shoes, the energy we expend on the everyday business of physical life. These too can serve as a korban to God when they are eaten in holiness, when the money is honestly earned, when the food is kosher, and our everyday activities are conducted in a way that is considerate of our fellows and faithful to the divine laws of life. In all korbanot, the blood and the fat are offered on the altar. The blood of the animal soul, its fervor and passion for material things, must be poured upon the altar. Its fat, its excessive indulgence and pleasure-seeking, must be burned. But the gist of the animal self, its meat, can be sanctified also when it is not wholly converted. When it is not wholly converted into a holy act. As long as they are eaten in holiness, our material endeavors can be a korban, a means of a bringing close our lives to God. So, that's the Rebbe's essay. By the way, this concept that the Rebbe adds at the end, this statement, I mean, the whole essay is really about this, but as long as they, and that are the, those are the promptings of the animal soul when they are, when it is properly mitigated, when it is properly harnessed and directed in the right way to facilitate or accomplish a worthwhile objective, as long as they are eaten in holiness, our material endeavors can be a korban. Our material endeavors can be a korban. In other words, what it is, for example, that we do for a living, right? Whether we're an electrical contractor, whether we're an IT specialist, right? Whether we're, a trauma counselor or a business owner, right? Whatever it is that we do for a living can be turned into a korban if we do it in a way that honors God, right? So, over the years, this is just something that has had an impact in my life over the years, is this emphasis on the idea that whatever we do, if we do it in a way that honors God, it can provide a mechanism by which we, even in our daily lives, going about, the mundane affairs of daily life, even those things can be dedicated to the Lord in such a way as to have the effect of tikkun olam, repairing the world, shining as a light in a dark world, right? So it is a means of bringing ourselves close to God. So what we do for a living can be a means of bringing ourselves close to God, right? Depending upon what we do and how we do it. So this is something that we'll see. It comes up pretty often in the Rebbe's talks. At any rate, number one, we're going to go back and talk about a few of the details I alluded to. The sacrificed animal is a projection in the extra-human sphere that is outside and beyond of a process transpiring in the intra-human universe that is within. The process of sanctifying an animal begins in the heart of man, but is expressed or realized outwardly, that is, in the real world. Its efficacy requires both. And this is an important idea, too. Frankly, I wish the Rebbe just would have said it that way. It would have been a lot easier to read. But the fact is that what he has nailed down here is something that Yeshua frequently addresses in his teaching, too. The connection in life between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, and there must be both. One is not effective without the other. They go together in our lives. In other words, a sacrifice offered to the Lord without the right heart or without the right motive, and or a right heart or right motive without the proper sacrifice, does not produce the desired result, right? So, I've made this comment many, many times, but if you, in biblical times, took an offering to the Lord and you were just doing it out of a sense of obligation or duty, and not because you had a heart or were motivated by your heart to thank God for whatever the sacrifice was being offered for, or it involved a request for forgiveness, as would be true of a sin offering, for example, then all you succeed in doing is killing an animal. It does not have the desired effect. It does not draw you closer to the Lord, which is what the word korban, the word for offering, means. The word korban comes from the Hebrew root kedev, and it means to draw near, to draw close. So, this is an important issue in our lives, particularly because of passages like this one in Matthew 7. Nobody likes to imagine that a passage like this will apply to their lives, but I'm not sure how many people really give a passage like this any serious consideration. But Yeshua says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, on the day when judgment comes, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.' Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." Now, what's interesting about this parable, about this story regarding those who do things in the name of Yeshua, right, but don't really have the kind of relationship with God that Yeshua, right, challenges us to come to terms with, right? We all live in homes, and in each case, the rain comes down, the streams rise, the wind blows and beats against the house, right? The only difference between those of us whose house crashes to the ground and those of us whose house remains standing is what the house is actually built on, right? Those who build their house on the rock, which is the Messiah, right, God, those who build their house on the rock, on God, and are connected to God, not only in the things they do, but what's in their heart, or not only connected to God by what's in their heart, but also by the things they do, their home is built on the rock. There's an interesting passage in Ephesians chapter 6. The subject has to do with a statement he makes to slaves, and this idea often comes up, why slavery in biblical times is just not outright abolished or condemned. And of course, it's important to appreciate that in biblical times, in the Greek and Roman world, all nations, all people groups had slaves. It was a fact of life. But what Paul says here is very interesting. "Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey the Messiah. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but as slaves of the Messiah, notice, doing the will of God from your heart. In other words, not just going through the motions, but doing the will of God from your heart. And then he goes on to say, serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord, not people, because you know that the Lord will reward each one for whatever good they do, whether they are slave or free. And then Paul says something to the masters, and this reflects a Jewish perspective, because this was not something that that you would anticipate being said to a Roman or a Greek lord who owned slaves, because in the Roman and Greek world, slaves were property. In the Jewish world, slaves were people, right? And masters could not mistreat someone who had signed up essentially to serve them for a specific period of time. Slaves in biblical times, at least in Jewish society, were bond servants. In other words, they essentially leased themselves to a master in order to satisfy a debt, for example. But the fact of the matter is that they were people. They had to be treated like people, and masters could not, you know, could not treat them like chattel or property. And here, Paul says, and masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. So don't imagine for a second that you can get away with anything, with treating your slaves with disrespect or contempt, because it will only come back to bite you. God will see to it that it comes back to bite you. Another passage that addresses this issue with regard to being faithful to the Lord: do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. And whoever and anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. And whoever looks, but whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom, right? This is a reference to the Torah, and it's referred to as perfect, and it facilitates freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they have heard, but doing it, observing the Torah, they will be blessed in what they do. In 1 John, do not love the world or anything in the world. And this is not a statement regarding the world itself, but the world system, the way the world works, the way the Roman and Greek world worked. Okay? This has nothing to do with not appreciating the starry sky at night, or mountains high, or, you know, the amber waves of grain. I mean, it has nothing to do with not appreciating the beauty of nature. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in them. For everything in the world, and now he's going to define what he's talking about, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but whoever does the will of God lives forever. Whoever walks in God's ways lives forever. And we should define faith, trustfulness, steadfastness, in the terms that these passages describe. Number two, let's move on. The same is true of the beast in man. Nothing, not even the godly soul's keenest yearnings, matches the intensity and vigor with which the animal soul pursues its desires. Left to its own devices, the animal soul tends toward corrupt and destructive behavior. But the proper guidance and training can eliminate the negative expression of these potent drives and exploit them toward good and godly ends. So, there's an interesting passage in Psalm 34. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his holy people, for those who fear him lack nothing. Notice verse 10. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from telling lies. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. So, in one of the commentaries I have, this particular commentary from on the book of Psalms, Tehillim, there is an interesting observation. The young lions describes those who exert themselves excessively, like ferocious beasts, to acquire their sustenance. This from Ibn Ezra. So his take on this statement in the Psalms can be applied to the animal soul within us, right? And to its effort to accomplish its objectives or satisfy its needs. According to Rabbeinu Bachya, he observes, God provides for all of the weak creatures, such as the embryo inside the mother's womb, or the chick inside the unhatched egg. God sustains the bird in the sky and the fish in the sea. He even nourishes the tiny ant. But God may well deprive mighty creatures of their food, as we read concerning the strongest of animals. Young lions may want and hunger. He does this to demonstrate that it is not might or skill which assures man of his sustenance, only the will of God. Right? So, in spite of whatever effort we undertake to assure our success, we have to appreciate God's role in that success, God's role in providing us with opportunities, God's role in providing us with the talents that we have to accomplish whatever it is that he has called us to, right? So all of these things are ultimately something which speak to the sustenance that God provides. So there is a very straightforward passage that deals with this from Matthew 6. Do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, in all of his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow, is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. And by the way, this passage obviously doesn't mean you shouldn't care at all about what you wear or what you eat or what you do for a living, right? That's not the intent, right? The intent is don't be consumed by these things, right? But seek first God's kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. The subject today reminded me of a story called The Two Wolves Legend. An old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life. "A fight is going on inside me," he said to the boy. "It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego." He continued, "The other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside you and inside every other person, too." So the grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf will win?" And the old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed." The one you feed. It's a great story. And, you know, the animal soul, at least in Jewish thought, is not regarded as necessarily having all of these evil attributes, right? But it does bring up this rabbinic duality of the Yetzer Hara, the so-called evil inclination, and the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, and that it is more subtle than the names themselves connote. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is not a demonic force that pushes a person to do evil, but rather a drive toward pleasure or property or security, which, if left unlimited, can lead to evil. When properly controlled by the Yetzer HaTov, the Yetzer Hara leads to many socially desirable results, including marriage and business and community, right? So, in this comment, the Midrash on the book of Genesis is mentioned, so I'd like to look at that for a second. Nachman said in Rabbi Samuel's name, "Behold, it was very good," refers to the good desire, and "behold, it was very good" to the evil desire. Can then the evil desire be very good? Not by very good, but be very good. That would be extraordinary. But for the evil desire, however, no man would. But for the evil desire, however, no man would build a house, take a wife, beget children. And thus said Solomon again, "I considered all labor and all excelling in work, that it is a man's rivalry with his neighbor," right? So, it is the evil desire which in the first place inspires this rivalry which leads to great efforts. One may triumph over his human failings by turning even them to noble purposes, right? So the evil desire, which is kind of misnamed, but the Yetzer Hara, right? It can facilitate good things in our lives too. It just needs to be regulated. It just needs to be controlled. It just needs to be attended to, right? In other words, its desire for things cannot overshadow those things which we treasure and value as ultimately important in life. Okay? Moving forward to this passage in Romans 7, this passage comes up frequently, but in Romans 7, Paul writes, "Does this mean that something good resulted in my dying? Out of the question. But sin, in order to be identified as sin, caused my death through that good thing, the Torah. And so it is by means of the commandment that sin shows its unbounded sinful power. We are well aware that the law is spiritual, but I am a creature of flesh and blood, sold as a slave to sin. I do not understand my own behavior. I do not act as I mean to, but I do things that I hate. While I am acting as I do not want to, I still acknowledge the law as good. So it is not myself acting, but the sin which lives in me." And of course, this sin is the sin which lives in the heart, right? The evil inclinations that often characterize us. And he says, really, I know of nothing good living in me, in my natural self, that is, for though the will to do what is good is in me, the power to do it is not. And of course, this is an expression of hyperbole as well. Paul is trying to emphasize the kind of struggle that takes place, in our lives. And it's a struggle, I'm sure, that you can identify with, because it's a struggle with you, which you deal with as well. Paul deals with it. And it's important for us to appreciate the fact that it is, well, it's kind of endemic or natural to all mankind, right? The good thing I want to do, I never do. And of course, it would be inappropriate to say Paul never did the good thing that he wanted to do. He frequently did the good thing he wanted to do, but he's trying to express this in graphically opposed terms. Do you understand? And by the way, if you read rabbinic literature, they do the same thing, right? They have what Westerners regard as absolutely inane arguments about things, for example. Like, one example which comes to mind is the argument in the rabbinic literature over what lawful things may be taken into consideration when a man wants to divorce his wife, right? And one of the rabbis, you know, his view was a man can only divorce his wife for impropriety, for sexual impropriety, for unfaithfulness. Of course, unfaithfulness, can be defined in a couple of ways, but the interpretation of what is or isn't unfaithfulness is very strict, right? Another rabbi makes the comment that a man can divorce his wife if she burns his toast. And, you know, Westerners who read a statement like this think to themselves, the rabbis are arguing that a woman can be divorced if she burns her husband's toast? I mean, come on. These people are morons. Why should I continue reading anything? Right? But of course, it's an example of what Paul is doing here. In other words, the two opposite extremes are being expressed in the argument, and the objective is to find the truth in the middle. Right? That's the point. At any rate, the evil thing which I do not want, that is what I do. But every time I do what I do not want to, then it is not myself acting, but the sin that lives in me, right? At any rate, moving on to the third idea. The first type of korban described in the book of Leviticus is the olah, the ascent offering, commonly referred to as the burnt offering. The olah is unique in that it is an absolute offering. After it is slaughtered in the temple courtyard and its blood poured upon the altar, it is brought up to the top of the altar and is burned in its entirety as a fiery pleasure unto God. So, with regard to the olah, the burnt offering, perhaps the best-known class of offerings is the burnt offering. It was the oldest and commonest sacrifice and represented submission to God's will. The Hebrew word for burnt offering is olah, which means ascension. An olah is completely burnt on the outer altar. No part of it is eaten by anyone. Because the offering represents complete submission to God's will, the entire offering is given to God. That is, it cannot be used after it is burnt. So even the ashes of the burnt offering cannot be used for anything else. And it expresses a desire to commune with God and expiate sins, incidentally, in the process. Because how can you commune with God if you are tainted with sins? An olah could be made from cattle, sheep, goats, or even birds, depending upon the offerer's means, right? So the offerer's ability to acquire a sacrifice suitable for a burnt offering depended upon their financial resources, right? An interesting or important aspect of how all of this works has to do with something I've mentioned many times, that the earthly tabernacle was to be a reflection of the heavenly tabernacle, and that applies to the five offerings as well, right? So the burnt offering is one of five offerings that reflect the glory of the one offering rendered in heaven. The offering, of course, takes place before the foundation of the world and in space and time. In the first century of the Common Era, the Messiah, his body, is nailed to a cross. He dies. He dies as a way of sacrifice or atoning for the sins of the world, according to the Gospels. But the point is that in many ways, Yeshua's sacrifice can be easily identified with the burnt offering because the burnt offering is wholly consumed, right, by the fire of the altar. And Yeshua, he was wholly consumed by the sacrifice that he makes too. In Hebrews 5 it says, during the days of Yeshua's life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard, notice, because of his reverent submission, which is exactly what the olah represents, the reverent submission of the offerer, right? But in the case of the olah, it's the animal which is wholly consumed, not the offerer, right? The offerer is recognized. It's his sacrifice, his olah, is recognized as a pleasing aroma, a sweet fragrance to God, right? Something in which the Lord delights. Okay? Son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered, and once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. And he was designated by God to be a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. In John 12, there's another comment about this, where some Greeks come to Philip and ask if they could meet with Yeshua. These are Gentiles who come to the feast of Passover. They want to meet privately with Yeshua, so they go to Philip. Philip goes to Yeshua, and says they would like to see Yeshua. And Philip went to and tells Andrew. Andrew and Philip in turn tell Yeshua, but Yeshua responds, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Right? So he essentially turns them away. But in verse 27, now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No. It was for this very reason I came to this hour. Right? So it was something which occupies the heart and the actions of Yeshua from the moment he makes the transition from his childhood into adulthood, right? And we see evidence of this in his staying behind when his family went home after the Passover, that they come to Jerusalem to observe Passover like good Jews do in the first century. But when his family left, he stayed behind, you remember? And Yeshua, they finally find him 3 days later on the Temple Mount speaking to the scholars of the day. And he said, what were you looking for me for? Didn't you know I had to be about my Father's house or my Father's business, right? And he obviously wasn't talking about, a carpentry contract. He was talking about his role as Messiah. In Matthew 17, during the Transfiguration, Matthew cites the fact that Moses and Elijah appear with Yeshua, and Peter, James, and John, who are with Yeshua on Mount Hermon when the Transfiguration takes place, they hear God's voice. And the Lord says, this is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. And it's interesting to me, because this expression with regarding God is well pleased, it comes up in the Gospels actually a few times. It comes up when Yeshua is immersed in all of the Gospels that record that event. There is a voice from heaven saying, this is my Son in whom I am well pleased. Peter makes a comment with regard to this observation too, right? That the Messiah, he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory saying, this is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him, right? What's interesting to me is that the only passage that I could find a kind of a parallel to would be this passage from Isaiah 42. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged until he establishes justice on earth. Right? So in the life of the Messiah, we see these two things, these two details that are associated with the olah, the burnt offering in the tabernacle. And this is intended to reflect the glory of the one sacrifice that Yeshua offers at the heavenly tabernacle, right? The idea that like the olah, the Messiah is submitted to God and to God's will, and he is submitted to God for his entire life, and that submission is regarded by God as a sweet fragrance, right? In other words, God delights in Messiah because of his fervent devotion to the things that God has called him to. Right. So this is an important idea. Lastly, in all korbanot, the blood and the fat are offered on the altar. The blood of the animal soul, its fervent and passion for material things, must be poured upon the altar. Its fat, its excessive indulgence and pleasure seeking, must be burned. Right. And there are many passages that speak to this, but one of the best known is from Micah 6. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God, right? But in the book of Zechariah, the prophet says much the same thing. And the word of the Lord came again to Zechariah. This is what the Lord Almighty said. Administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the foreigner or the poor. Do not plot evil against each other, right? So these are ways in which the animal soul needs to be regulated and constrained and directed to accomplish, good things, not only in our lives and in the lives of the community, right, but in the world as well, right? A way of shining a light into a dark world. Okay, so I'm going to stop here, see if there are any comments or questions about what we've talked about today. Anybody?
Just a comment of appreciation. I appreciate you including the Two Wolves legend story. That lesson at the end there makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I love that story. I think it just happened to go very well with what the Rebbe was talking about today and, you know, what we discussed. It's a great story. And by the way, Ed, I appreciate you bringing that up because I think it demonstrates the fact that there is wisdom in other cultures too, not just our own, right? And it's something we should grow to appreciate, frankly. I mean, I get these posts, frequently, and, you know, some of them with regard to, a Native American history or Indigenous American history, however you want to refer to it. It's, there is a lot of wonderful wisdom communicated in some of these stories and anecdotes, these sayings, right? So I think it is important to cite examples of occasions in other cultures where we can appreciate the wisdom of a saying, right? Good, thanks, Ed. Anybody else before we go? It looks like a few of you are thinking about it, but
a couple of questions in the chat.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. Oh, good. Appreciate it. Here's from Susanna. Shabbat Shalom. In the millennium, what sacrifices will be made? Will there be sin offerings as people, unbelievers? Will still be sinning? A Reform rabbi made the comment that biblical Judaism was extinct because there is no more temple sacrifices. I'm not sure that I would say biblical Judaism is extinct. I would say it certainly has been modified by the unavailability of the sacrifices. But according to statements that Yeshua makes regarding the celebration of Passover and the celebration of Sukkot from the book of Zechariah during the millennium, and the last eight chapters of the book of Ezekiel, when the Messiah comes, he will build or rebuild the third temple, and the sacrifices will be offered once again. And all of the sacrifices that are described in the book of Leviticus are described as being offered again in much the same detail, right? So it doesn't go quite into the same detail as the first 17 chapters of the book of Leviticus, but they are all identified individually, right? So the burnt offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, those offerings are once again offered at the millennial temple. The question, of course, has to do with why, right? But it is related to something I say repeatedly, that the earthly tabernacle reflects the glory of the heavenly tabernacle, right? So people will come to appreciate that every single time a sacrifice is offered, whether it's at a holiday, whether it's an individual bringing a sacrifice, whatever it might be, that every single sacrifice ever offered, either at the wilderness tabernacle or the Israelite temple in Jerusalem or at the millennial temple, all of those sacrifices have and will continue to attest to the one sacrifice that the Messiah offers on our behalf, right? So we will see the connection between these sacrifices and the sacrifice of Messiah, and so will everyone who participates in, who's alive during the millennium. By the way, with regard to sin, people who are in spiritual bodies when the Messiah returns to earth, which would be his people, those who have died in faith in biblical times, those who are transformed when we meet the Lord in the air, coming to earth, or those who die in Messiah before he returns, we will have spiritual bodies, and we will be ruling and reigning with the Messiah, whatever that means. We don't really know. The text is not really explained. But there will be mortals alive during the millennium as well. Those who survive the judgment of the nations will enter the millennium as mortal beings. I think because Yeshua will be ruling with a rod of iron, that sin won't develop in the way it develops now, here. If you were to ask me, will people continue to sin? As difficult as it is to imagine, I guess the appropriate answer would be yes, although sin will not find the expression during the millennium that it finds now on earth, right? So I would say that sin will be dramatically more controlled than it is now. I would hate to say that there will be no sin, right? But that period of time is characterized as a time of peace and security and safety. And, of course, it would not be possible to characterize it like that if sin ran rampant like it does today, right? Because we don't live in peace. We don't live in security. We don't live in safety, right? I mean, we have to be aware of a whole host of matters when we venture out. It's not like we go about life without a care in the world, right? But in the millennium, every man will sit beneath his vine and fig tree. So I would say that either there will not be much sin, or it will be dramatically curtailed, right? And the offerings that are offered at the temple aren't just sin offerings. I mean, you know, there's sacrifices offered with all of the holidays, on Passover, on Sukkot, on all of the holidays, various sacrifices are offered. So I would guess that they would be offered then too, right? Which, by the way, makes the understanding that the Messiah's single sacrifice ended sacrifices is not an accurate view regarding what the author of Hebrews says about the sacrifice of the Messiah in the book of Hebrews. Okay? It's a popular Christian notion, but it's not biblical. Very good. Anybody else before we go? Thank you, Susanna. I hope that answered the question. Yeah, David, go ahead.
Rabbi, the sacrifices, though, for the sin offering was for unintentional sins. And so, would you say in the millennium as well, any or most or the majority of sin would be unintentional? It seems to me that, like, the rebellion that's going on today just wasn't tolerated back then.
It
was probably dealt with swiftly and quickly and not as prevalent as it is in our current, in our society.
Yeah. I agree. But rebellion, you know, the structure, the way our societies work today, particularly in the United States, was different than it worked in biblical times among the people of Israel. But you're right, when the people rebelled against the Lord often raised up someone to oppress them, right, so that they were brought to a place where they realized that their sin had unforeseen consequences. And they lived with those unforeseen consequences. They cry out to God. God raises up a judge to deliver them, which they do. And then for a period of time, they walk in God's ways. And when the judge passes away, they revert to their old ways. And the cycle just repeats. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read through the book of Judges, but it's the same story told 12 times, right? It's like, come on, come on, you guys, what the hell's going on here? You know, but it just keeps happening. And it happens among the northern tribes of Israel. It happens among the southern tribes, right? The same thing occurs, except that with those two occasions, the Lord leads his people are exiled from the land, you know, to come back. Indeed, they do come back, but you're right. I mean, it seems as if sin and the consequences of sin have been unregulated for a very, very long time, right? And it's sometimes hard to know. I would guess that there are times when God does act against a nation, for example, because of the way it does something or because of the way people are treated, right? And I would guess that there have been occasions, right, when the Lord does that. But the problem is, well, let's let's just talk about Hurricane Katrina for a second. All right, Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans in 2005. It's hard to believe it was 20 years ago, right? But I remember in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina that there were all kinds of Christian pastors talking about, you know, the way God used Hurricane Katrina to punish New Orleans because of its affinity for the gay community, right? And there was a gay pride march that occurs through, you know, through the downtown district of New Orleans. What's it called, that downtown area of
North? French Quarter.
The French Quarter, right. Thanks. Right down through the French Quarter, right? The problem is that it was the poorest of the communities in New Orleans that were inundated with floodwaters. The French Quarter it got wet, but the French Quarter didn't flood. In other words, the heart of the gay community in New Orleans, the place where the gay pride parade takes place in New Orleans, wasn't catastrophically affected by the hurricane. Whereas, you know, many of the areas which were destroyed. I mean, and I've been going to New Orleans to speak for years, many years, like 3 years after, 2 or 3 years after Katrina, and you could, I mean, the devastation it was remarkable, but not in the French Quarter. It was all in some of the poorer areas of the community. So you have to wonder if God is the one who was responsible for Hurricane Katrina, and if he was punishing New Orleans because of its affinity for the gay community, then he missed. That's the bottom line. He missed. And in biblical times, when God chastises a community and the leadership of a community, it's the leadership of the community that's affected by whatever it is that God is doing, right? So, a hurricane that devastates, you know, the panhandle of Florida, for example, you know, in the area where Tampa is, for example, I mean, it doesn't strike me that that can be a punishment against the leadership of a nation that resides in Washington, D.C., but nothing happened in Washington, D.C., right? So in what way can that natural event be attributed to God's punishment against this nation for whatever particular sin, and it always is homosexuality. I mean, that's the typical sin for which the United States is being punished, right? But either that is not the case, or God misses a lot, right? I mean, you know, I'm not an expert marksman, but, you know, I hit the target more often than God does, apparently. And making a statement like that is, you're out of your mind, right? So, you have to be out of your mind to make a statement that suggests that God is punishing a people for something, but he continually misses his objective, right? I mean, that just brings ridicule to the person who speaks it, not oh my goodness, we better get our act together. Right? That just generates ridicule, which is a bad thing in my opinion. At any rate, David, thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you. Let's see. There are a couple of more chats. Okay, this one from Beth Ann. I'm amazed and humbled by how often each week's study on the Parsha, as well as scriptures that I've read and heard so often, teach me where I am currently. Great study. Thank you. Rabbi Bob and everyone. So thank you, Beth Ann. I appreciate that. Yeah. I find that to be true in my life too. I am often, I often find myself thinking the same thing, you know, that the subject that we are talking about, this Shabbat, you know, that probably has to do with why I select the particular essay I do, right? Because there's usually between 3 and 10 essays on each portion, but I tend to avoid the really long ones because I don't want to be reading for 45 minutes. But otherwise, thank you, Beth Ann. From Rivka, almost every chapter in Judges begins with, and the people did that which was right in their own eyes. And some Philistine or Amalekite shows up. Rinse and repeat, which is a great way of expressing it, right? I mean, the book of Judges is definitely rinse and repeat. And it happens frequently in the book of Judges. I mean, it's filled with great stories, right? But you have to think to yourself, people, you know, what's that saying about history? Those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. That saying is certainly true based upon what we read about in the book of Judges, right? The people just don't get it. And whatever happens, happens again and again and again and again, right? And yet, God is so gracious and loving that he doesn't abandon his people entirely. He, you know, corrects them. From Susanna, at Yom Kippur, the offering for the nation, was that for intentional or unintentional sin with God, excluding with your neighbor? And were personal sin offerings for both? I'm confused. Yeah, it's not difficult to be confused by the way the offerings work, because the offerings that we read about in the first 17 chapters of Leviticus, chapters 16 and 17 having to do with the offering on Yom Kippur, the various offerings that are mentioned in the first few chapters are for unintentional sin. Unintentional sin is when you do something that you didn't realize was wrong, but when you do come to realize that it was wrong, then you have to make, you have to make a correction. So you acknowledge the sin, you bring an animal, and depending upon the offering, it depends on what you can afford, but you bring an animal, you lay your hand on the head of the animal, you confess your sin, it has to come from your heart, and either you or the priest, if you are skilled in the slaughter of animals, then you can execute the animal. If you're not, the priest executes the animal on your behalf, right? But depending upon the kind of offering it is, the offering is either wholly consumed on the altar, the burnt offering, The sin offering is something that the priests eat a part of. The peace offering is something that the offerer takes a portion of. But the point is that those offerings are for unintentional sin. Intentional sin, the Hebrew expression is bayad ramah, sin with a high hand. That is like a sin in which you shake your fist in God's face and dare him to do something about it, right? That kind of a sin is treated, I was going to say harshly, but justly would be better. I mean, that kind of a sin is treated very justly, and it's treated in a hard way. But the offering on Yom Kippur is an offering for the community, and we confess our sin to God, which may involve the violation of an oath, for example, something that we still do. If you go to a synagogue on Yom Kippur, for example, you confess a whole litany of sins, some of which you may have committed and some of which you haven't, right? All kinds of things. Everything you can imagine is mentioned. And that kind of confession is probably drawn originally from the confession that was made by the people on Yom Kippur when these animals were offered to the Lord. The one slaughtered, the one removed from the community and released in the wilderness, right? So that's what happens. What's interesting, in my view, is that in Isaiah 53, the sin that the Messiah sacrifices himself for on the part of the people employs all of the Hebrew words for sin. In other words, chata, which is sin, missing the mark, right? But we have other words for sin. Rebellion, wickedness, irreverence. I mean, right? In other words, if you look in Isaiah 53, you'll see that rebellion and wickedness and other egregious sins are mentioned, and these are things for which the Messiah is punished on our behalf, right? So, like I have mentioned many times, the offerings offered at the tabernacle, there are five of them, and then, you know, the offering on Yom Kippur, but the sacrifices, they only address an aspect of the complete work of Messiah, right? No one sacrifice can accomplish what the work of the Messiah accomplishes, right? So, we shouldn't think of any of those offerings as accomplishing in and of themselves what the one sacrifice of Messiah does, right? So, when you think of Yeshua as a sin offering, don't equate it with the sin offering offered in the Bible, because it's not identical, right? I mean, his one sacrifice accomplishes things that all of those sacrifices joined together accomplish. So everything that the earthly sacrifices represent are things that the death of Messiah facilitates. Right, so it's an important idea to keep in mind. Good, thank you, Susanna. Let's see, from Rivka, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed for hatred of foreigners, illegal aliens, as we call them now, not sex. Yeah, there's it's interesting how this issue has become the issue it has. I'm not completely sure why, but in the Tanakh, in the Bible, when the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah is mentioned, and what God does to punish them for what they do, homosexuality is not mentioned, right? They are punished for their lack of hospitality, right? Because they didn't extend care to the people in the community who needed it, right? They had hardened their hearts against the Lord. And of course, Sodom and Gomorrah are not Jewish communities. They're pagan communities, Gentile communities. But as we've learned, Gentiles have an obligation to the seven Noahide commandments, and those instructions require a system of justice, that extends care to the needy, to the poor. Yeah, the passage, one of the passages in Rivka, I appreciate you adding this. Look up Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 50, right? The reason for Sodom and Gomorrah's demise is their lack of care, their lack of compassion, their inhospitality to the stranger, to the foreigner, right? So, it's something which should inform, our communities too. Right? They were not Jewish. Just like the United States. The United States is not a Jewish nation. It's a nation like other nations. But in this nation, we do have an obligation to walk in the commandments or the instructions that God gave Noah, right? And a system of courts, just scales, just wages, just courts, right? Judges that don't take bribes, right? There are a number of things, a belief in God, a prohibition against idolatry, right? There are several things that are supposed to characterize all nations, not just Israel. So, those come from the Torah too. Good. Thank you, Rivka. Appreciate the comment. Anybody else before we go?
Couple comments, Bob.
Yeah.
This recent talk or recent comments that you're addressing here, I was thinking about an anthropologist, famous anthropologist and sociologist, Margaret Mead, who did a lot of research and study in the Pacific Islanders. And she made a comment many, many years ago. I think Margaret Mead is now passed. But many years ago, she made the comment in her research that the first sign of civilization was when she was looking at the skeletal remains of people that had died long before. And when she would see a skeletal structure where a person had a broken bone and it had healed. It had healed from her point of view because someone took the time to set the bone so that it would heal properly. In other words, the first sign of civilization, according to her, was the skeletal remains of people that had received care. And she particularly noted when she observed this in the bones of children. And that's kind of where I'm at and have been for a long time because of the work that I do. And I just spent the morning with several hundred people who kind of feel the same way, that oftentimes the largest number of victims are our children.
Yeah.
And even when there are so-called state services or organizational or institutional services that are designed for children, most often they're not as effective as they could be. I've worked for several years now with state agencies that are responsible for removing children from their family of origin because they're not safe. The children are not being cared for, they're neglected, or they're being abused. And so they're brought into the foster care system. And we can be grateful that those children were removed from unsafe environments, but in so many cases, and when I say so many, I'm talking in excess of 100,000 cases per year throughout the United States. Hmm. These children are placed in other conditions that are equally or even sometimes more harmful.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to be a criticism of a foster care program or system, but what it means is that while some organizations and some people espouse, their mantra is, we are seeking the best interest of the child. But when you talk to representatives of state agencies, what they will tell you behind the scenes when there's not a camera on and someone's not recording them, what they will tell you is that, no, the first priority is to reduce the state's liabilities. In other words, if I worked for a foster care program of some state, while I might be doing that kind of work because of my compassion for children, the agency that I'm working for is telling me that's a secondary concern.
Yeah.
The primary concern is to get the state's finances off the hook. And balancing a budget or reducing opportunities for people to sue the state, which is all a part of state's liabilities, that takes precedence over what is in the best interest of the child. Children suffer. And so when I think about this conversation that we're having, the differences between unintentional and intentional sins. When you hold up that fist, and I've seen you do this many times now, you know, this is the intentional sin. This is waving my fist in the face of God. And it's not always an overt, outward wave my fist in front of God. Sometimes it can be a little bit more cryptic and subtle than that. And Yeshua said, for those of you who harm these little ones, well, I've got a suggestion for you. There's an alternative that would be better. And that alternative is to take one of those olive presses, stones, and chain it around your neck, and you'd be dropped into the sea. Harsh. Well, yeah. But the harshness that so many children are experiencing is incredible. So there is I'll just give you one example, because I'm starting to feel like I'm even on my own soapbox here, so I need to be careful. There is a law. There's a federal law. It's not just a state law. It's a federal law that when a child has been separated and brought out from a family of origin where their family home is unsafe and not caring for them, the federal law says the state government has 15 months to find and help that original family to be safe to return that child. And if that doesn't happen, then the federal law mandates that parental rights be severed and that child be given an opportunity to be adopted by a family that will care and nurture it. How many states out of 50 do you think is following that law? None. That means children are living not with their mom and dad, but they're being tossed from one family to another to another to another in a foster care system without permanency, without a sense of stability, without a place that they grow into and feel, this is home. I belong and I'm loved. All 50 states are violating that law. Now, you know, maybe I'm caught up in my own passions and I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But that feels like this.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yep, it absolutely does. Yeah. I don't know what it's like in other nations, what the circumstances, you know, the child care process in other countries is like, but I can't imagine it's much different than it is here.
Right now, in this country, if a child at the age of 3 to 6 years of age is brought into the foster care system, there is a 65% chance that child will never know permanency. That means if they never know permanency, they will, quote, age out of foster care. Because once the child turns 18, the state says, we are no longer liable for you.
Right.
You're on your own. Of that population of young people who age out of foster care, this is going to blow you away if you haven't heard this one before. Of the people who age out of foster care without permanency, 80% of them end up in prison.
Yeah.
80% are incarcerated.
So we should we should evaluate very seriously if whether or not that is a grounds for this nation being punished.
Widows and orphans, there's the focal point, right?
Yep.
The most vulnerable people among us. And I recall in the first century that the goy, the Gentile followers of Yeshua did not have an inherent system as the Jewish community did
right.
for the care of widows and orphans.
Correct.
This is why they set up the deacon idea, right, in the book of Acts, is because the Gentile or non-Jewish community didn't have a built-in system in their communities. I mean, they didn't even have a community. The Jews had a community. The Gentiles, well, you know, whatever you had, but it was not this kind of system that was effective from one generation to the next.
Right. Yeah, in the first century synagogue, a deacon was not someone who set up and took down chairs. A deacon was the person who was responsible for distributing congregational resources to the orphans, to the widows, to the poor, evaluating needs in the community and acting on the behalf of the needy using congregational resources. That's what they did. So, yeah, the Jewish community did have a mechanism for dealing with this, right?
You know, people ask me, because this is, again, part of the world that I work in, people ask me, why does this nation insist on separating children from their parents when the parents have entered into this country illegally? Because that's a practice we have. And they ask, why do we do that? You have to know history. Because we did it with the Native Americans. We separated children from their parents and we sent them to places that here in Phoenix, they're still existing, called Indian schools. Indian day schools. They still exist. We still do this.
Yeah.
Well, if you go back to the colonial period, this nation was founded upon a European idea called
What just happened? Manifest destiny is what he was going to say.
I know, he just lost him. Back it on that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he'll chime back in or try to get back in. Come on, Roderick. Well, I suppose I could call him.
Now, the practice he was referring to took place in Canada in an extreme way as well. And quite frankly, here in this country, with enslaved people who were brought in from Africa and other places.
Yep.
Separating families was a way of weakening families, you know?
Absolutely. And controlling, the byproduct, right? Controlling, what would happen when that wasn't done. Yeah.
Word I use for is insidious.
Yeah. Let me look. There's a couple of chats. Hopefully Roderick will connect back. Rivka made a comment. Roderick shared I love that that story that Roderick shared about Margaret Mead. There he is. And the sign of civilization is a set broken bone, right? Because you can see that in the skeletons, where a bone has not been set, and the leg did not heal properly, and a bone that was set, and the leg does heal properly, right? Margaret Mead also said, the greatest force in the universe is a menopausal woman. Trauma is the gateway drug. Someday, she says, I'll share my story about the 14 foster homes I endured between the ages of 15 and 18. 14 foster homes between 15 and 18. Yeah. From Bob and Jan, enjoy this time with you all. Have to go, shalom. Susanna writes, sorry to say, but the state's primary interest sounds much like too many school districts. My experience as a retired teacher, outwardly for the students, practically for district and administrative policies, right? Yeah. I mean, I only did it for a year, but I was thinking of going into teaching as well, and did a year as a student teacher in an elementary school in where I was living in Southern California. And, that was a great experience in a lot of ways, but I learned a lot about the school system and the way the system works. Roderick, good to have you back. Can you pick up where you left off? You stopped on the word destiny and disappeared.
This country was, part of it was founded upon a European idea called manifest destiny. And consequently, part of the practices that is that's mandated out of that, essentially manifest destiny, if you're not familiar with it, and I don't mean to insult anybody's intelligence, but I don't want to assume that everyone understands these things, that manifest destiny was essentially the idea of the white man, if you will, the white person, dominating and being the God's chosen to mandate and to populate and to run this world. And people of color, people who were not Caucasian, people who were not of that European descent, then, they were ostracized. And so, consequently, we had practices like separating children from their parents so that they could be indoctrinated. Because these schools where we put the Native American children only taught English, and they would not allow anything cultural that these people were familiar with, their songs, their dances, their cultural diets and practices, they were immediately labeled as pagan. Well, that's a practice that in this country we still follow. And it's also why from a post-Civil War period up through the late 1970s that this country practiced eugenics, the involuntary sterilization of women from particular people groups that were determined or deemed undesirable. And finally, eugenics was outlawed. But it was a common practice under the guise of mental health.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm grateful that Hashem doesn't slumber or sleep. that his arm has not shortened, nor is his memory short. And there is my mom used to say to me, Roderick, you can count on it. There's a reckoning coming. But I'm grateful that there's going to be a redemption, because I hate to experience that reckoning without redemption.
Yeah, but there's going to be both a reckoning and a redemption. Yeah. And the injustice that you described, not just in this country, but on the part of all governments that oppress their citizens, that reckoning is not going to be very pleasant. Yeah. Good. Amen. Thank you, Roderick. I appreciate the comments. Looks like there's another.
Feels a little bit like that's what's happening now.
It does. I agree.
More than a little bit. Maybe.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, and I think a comeuppance is, you know. Yep, from Rivka, absolutely everything Roderick said. She has the icon of a broken heart. Set the captives free. Yeah. So that is something that the Lord will do when he comes. So, right, at this point, it doesn't seem like he could come soon enough, does it? Particularly based upon everything that's going on, right? I mean, we are definitely living in trying times.
But we have hope.
But we do. We not only have hope, but we, you know, we should be able to, you know, live with hope and with the expectation that, you know, like Roderick just mentioned, you know, God doesn't miss much, right? So he certainly knows what's going on as well in ways that we can't begin to hope to, right? The Lord knows what's happening. He knows who's responsible for it. And people won't get away whatever it is that they think they are. And you would think that would be a sobering thought. And I think it is for many people, but for others, it's not. Which is, that's part of the great tragedy, that it's not. You know.
Well, the very thing that we're talking about, this is what's missed in our churches, because they won't talk like we're talking now. And it's what's missed, because that's why there's a lot of things that I'm ignorant of. Because when I hear y'all talk, this is my first time hearing certain things, because it's not shared in the majority of the Christian community. So again, this is the type of thing that has to be talked about, because a lot of people are ignorant and don't realize that these things are going on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great... that's a great observation too, because when people are unaware of what's taking place, you know, the turmoil that they experience in their everyday lives seems random. And it's not, right? It's not random at all, right? Yeah, that's one of the, I think, the valuable aspects of the book of Judges, right? We talked about, you know, it tells the same story over and over 12 times, but But the important thing about the book of Judges is that there are consequences to our behavior, and we need to be aware of those consequences and the fact they're real, right? And I think that's one of the things that tends to be characteristic of the criminal element in our society is they act as if they are above the law and it doesn't apply to them, and they'll never be held accountable for whatever it is that they're doing, right? And frankly, when someone operates on that basis, it's kind of scary. Also from Rivka, the arc of justice is long, but justice and mercy prevail. It is it in Habakkuk that says, my people die from lack of knowledge? Yeah, Habakkuk 4:6. My people die for lack of knowledge. Yep. And that lack of knowledge in Hebrew, it's experiential awareness, experiential knowledge of God, right? It's connecting what God says with what he does. And, you know, that... what's the word you used, Roderick, for it? Redemption and...
A reckoning.
Reckoning, right. The reckoning is coming. No doubt about it. The reckoning is coming. Right, so we just have to do our best to... reach people. Right? Be compassionate, be caring, right? Stand for justice and inequity, or against inequity. Yeah, a lot of places to be involved in this world, I'm afraid. Good. From Beth Ann, Joseph had a question about having a group Passover Seder. Oh. Okay. Yes. Joseph, do you want to? We're going to be doing our congregational or our virtual Seder on the 19th. That's the last day of Passover. So next Saturday evening is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So that's typically a day when families get together on the first and second night of Passover. So the last day is the 19th. The evening of the 19th is the, you know, that's when we'll be doing our Passover Seder on the 19th. In the place of this study, right? So the best thing to do, we'll be using the Ashav Haggadah, so it's good to get a Haggadah for everybody who may be participating in the Seder with you, and it's also good to make a Passover plate so that you can all, you know, you'll have matzah and you'll have haroset. There's a recipe in the Haggadah for Haroset. So you can, you know, you can have a shank bone from a lamb and all the things you need to participate in the Seder as if we were all together, right? Unless you'd all like to come here, that'd be okay too. That would be great.
Yeah, room for us all?
We would make room for you all.
Okay.
take all of the furniture out of one room, and you know what I've done in the past is taken all of the furniture out of a room and put a sheet of plywood, a 4x8 sheet of plywood, in the middle of the room on blocks, and then everybody sits around it. And it's amazing how many people you can get around a sheet of plywood. It was fun. We all sat on pillows on the floor. Good. If anyone wants help for Pesach, she says, text me. But it has to be a text because Rivka doesn't hear well. So if anyone has a question about Passover and what getting ready for the Seder might involve, you can reach her at 916-936-9076. Anytime, anyone. Okay? But you have to text. Text her, not call. She won't answer a call because she doesn't hear it, but you have to text it. Okay? Good. Thanks, Rivka. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'll be sending you something probably this upcoming week about the Seder on the 19th. Okay? Good. Anybody else before we go? We have discussed some hard things this week. Yeah, David.
Rabbi, it kind of begs, the question begs, how did we get to this point? And you said something earlier regarding the sin with the high hand and it being dealt with justly. And this quote came to mind. What evil or rebellion we tolerate will infiltrate, permeate, and then eventually dominate a culture or a people.
Yes. Who said that?
It just popped into my head.
Oh, great.
Yeah, what you said. And that's the reason why it needs to be dealt with justly and basically eliminated. Because
right.
God's going to hold a nation account if they tolerate stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, but, yeah. I mean, that's a very, I mean, it's hard to find the words to describe the way people treat others, right? The way people tend to put things over people. One of the places where I have done business, there was a post that I checked out. They gave their CEO a bonus of like, I don't know, $40 million bonus. At the same time, they laid off 10,000 employees. Right? And I stopped doing business there. And I wrote to them and told them, right? I mean, I asked them, you know, why something like that takes place, right? But all of these people who are laid off so that the CEO, who already makes a good deal of money, you know, can have an attitude, and you know, it's hard for me. I can't imagine someone needing, for example, to be a billionaire, right? I can't imagine what in the world you would do with all that money, right? Apart from doing what some people do with it, which is to, you know, to invest in schools or to invest in, you know, various community projects or, you know, to provide for scholarships for needy students or things like that. But the fact of the matter is that we are a money-driven culture that makes money, just like we learned already this afternoon, with regard to liability. We act in ways to protect the system and to, you know, protect investments and to, you know, unfortunately, in cases like that, many, many people are taken advantage of, right? And information that was once used to protect communities, like tornado notifications and hurricane notifications, from the National Weather Services and things like that, have been discontinued, right? I mean, I happen to live on my Social Security benefit, right? But Social Security has been gutted. I mean, you know, I don't know. I went to their website the other day and it didn't work. Their website was not operating properly. And, of course, you can't call because there isn't anybody answering the phones anymore. You know, I mean, it's crazy, right? So, those of us who depend upon Social Security, it's a big deal with regard to what happens to it, or Medicare, for example, right? I mean, the services that we provide are important, and yet, I don't know. It's quite frustrating to see, you know, to see what's going on, and the legitimate needs of people, and the research that takes place and needs to take place into things like cancer and, you know. You know, the measles outbreak in Texas, you know, and the advice that people are getting from the head of the health agency, that you just have to treat measles with vitamin A. And then people do that because they think it's a solution, but vitamin A destroys the liver. So people are dying of liver failure. Right, I mean, right. How many of you have heard that vitamin A is a legitimate treatment for measles? And the rise of measles continues. It's not only in Texas now, it's in other states too. Right? And a few years ago, measles wasn't even a disease, which anyone in the United States was concerned with, right? Because we were all vaccinated against it when we were young. I don't know. It's just, things have gotten incredibly crazy, right? It's just grieving, right? Hard to deal with the grief over the level of corruption that exists, the level of hatred that exists, the cruelty that exists, right? Like Roderick brought up, the fact that these Native American schools, these Indian schools, still exist and still do what they've always done, right? Anyway. anyway, it's it would not be difficult to be completely overwhelmed by these things. And, you know, and kind of want to bury your head in the sand and pretend that everything blows over. Right? But we have to do what we can. That's the thing. We have to do what we can and act in our own communities in ways that we can, you know, to facilitate justice and equality. I mean, this manifest destiny is, it's like the elders of the protocols of Zion, right? That's how. It's the same kind of destructive nonsense.
Rabbi, you said something too, that those who don't learn from the history are doomed to repeat it. And there was a book I read in, I believe it was in high school, Fahrenheit 451,
yeah,
where you're basically supposed to believe whatever the state says. And if you had books, they were confiscated and burned, and you were punished. And I just think about certain historical books being removed from public schools and not wanting to teach what really happened.
Yes.
It just seemed, I never thought I would be living that book. But unfortunately, that's what's happening in this society right now.
Yeah, I agree. I never imagined that I would be living that book either. Right? I mean,
in that book, firemen don't put out fires.
Right. They burn books. Right.
That's upside down.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things about our society that are upside down. Right? And, you know, I mean, race relations is one of them. You would think that the diversity of human life that exists, you would think that that would be an evidence of the creative work of God, as opposed to, you know, the view that one race is and has been put by God in a position of superiority over others. I mean, it is such an outrageously stupid concept. You know, it's just, it's mind-boggling, right? But it's the, you know, it's Christian nationalists who, you know, who are the ones who emphasize it. It's just some of the things that go on, you know, you shake your head and just want to cry. Right? It's hard to describe. You know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, you know, that Jewish activist who was imprisoned in Russia for many, many, many years. He made I don't know how old the comment is, but it was something I saw posted recently about his, he made a comment, an observation about the way some people treat others, right? People in positions of authority and in responsibility, and, you know, and the way people use power to subjugate others. And he made a comment that he can't think of a word in English to describe how bad that this is, right? He said the word evil doesn't begin to do it justice, right? The evil that exists and the evil that is perpetuated upon others, right? It's just, it is, it's difficult. It's difficult to imagine that people are treated the way they are by others. Let's see. Thank you, David. Rivka adds, I'm going with apathy, a general lack of loving kindness, right? That's one of the things that she talks about. People are apathetic, I agree. From Susanna, as we talk about these things, can't help but think of the hostage situation, atrocities committed, and how much of the world has and continues to remain silent. Evil is a word that comes to mind. Yeah, I mean, it's mind-boggling to look at the evidence of the way some of the hostages, many of the hostages were treated by Hamas, the way they were dismembered, sexually assaulted, even after some of them died, they were sexually assaulted and parts of their bodies were dismembered. They were found naked with their, women were found naked with their legs spread apart. I mean, it's just, and yet there are thousands and thousands of students in the United States at universities all over the world that are clamoring for support of Hamas, right? And this is apparently a legitimate methodology associated with, you know, providing for your political needs. This is an acceptable political strategy or military strategy to use against a people to facilitate your objective, right? It's just mind-boggling. That certainly is not the case in the Bible and not the case for Israel today, you know, and when they, you know, act militarily. Evil is a word that comes to mind. It's just not quite strong enough. From Beth Ann, I must go. Great study, comments, and community. Shavua Tov to a good and blessed week. From Rivka, lack of empathy unless it happens to you. Right? That, by the way, is something that Elon Musk said about the United States. People have too much empathy. Word on the street is that Nintendo gamers aren't having any of this, not getting their next number to something or another, and the game's getting double, quadruple in price. Gamers are going to stop this, but yeah, apparently that's among the things that are happening as a result of the tariffs. I know that these were heavy conversations, but I appreciate, this is from Charlene, I appreciate the fact that we have a place where we can discuss these things and hear these things in this caring community. I'm grateful for that. And from Rivka, me too, Charlene, from Ed, amen, Charlene, and from Rivka, Palestinians are turning against Hamas in spades. It isn't being journaled by the media, but it is occurring. I'm aware of that as well. Yeah, the Palestinians in Gaza are turning against Hamas in significant ways, meaningful ways. So, very good. Difficult discussion today. important. It's an important one to have. So, very good. Comments? Any other comments before we go? From Tina and David, Brother Keith, the book was Fahrenheit 451. Yeah, Fahrenheit 451.
Thanks. My screen kept pausing, so I didn't catch the name of the book.
Yeah, that's it, Fahrenheit 451. Oh, I didn't have there it is.
Ray Bradbury is the author.
Yeah, Ray Bradbury, that's correct. Good. Yeah.
So Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, then George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Yeah.
And if you're still up for reading material after that, then I'm going to forget the name of it. The Big Brother is watching.
You're talking about 1984.
1984, also a George Orwell.
Yeah.
Three reads that have a twinge of prophecy in them.
Yeah. But I agree with David. I mean, 1984, Fahrenheit 451, Animal Farm. I mean, these are books that, we read in the, in the 60s, right?
Yeah,
70s,
exactly.
But.
They were required reads.
Yeah. But I agree that you read these books now. I mean, reading them then is very different from reading them now. Right, because now the things that they talked about are actually happening in ways that it was impossible to imagine then, right? But not so possible to imagine for Ray Bradbury and George Orwell. Yeah, amazing. Yeah, from Rivka, feels like the 70s, rinse and no, repeat. She also has a citation here, Marvin Gaye, The Ecology Song. Yeah. A lot of good literature, a lot of good music that addresses these issues, huh? Just need to pay attention to it. Lord of the Flies is another one that Susanna mentioned. Yeah, not nice. Baruch Hashem, we are living, as I mentioned, in troubling times, but we just have to trust the Lord and stick together, right? That's what we do. Trust the Lord and stick together. And celebrate the diversity that characterizes us. Not something anyone should ever be afraid of. I'm not sure why that is so prevalent. Yeah. Very good. Thank you, everyone, from Susanna Shavuot Tov. Rivka mentions 1984, George Orwell. Good. Okay. Well, I will say, Laila Tov, may the Lord be with you. Don't give up. Hang in there. Trust the Lord. And I have complete confidence that the Lord is following what is taking place and will act accordingly at the right time. Right? Very good. Shavuot Tov. Have a good week.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Bye for now.
Recording stopped.